This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
An interesting and wide-ranging political discussion is what you're in store for. Two very interesting guests. Rick DeGraw, longtime Democratic political operative and general political player. And Tom Ryan, an even more frequent guest on this show, general troublemaker, attorney, and stir of the pot. But first, I want to acknowledge later this week, two anniversaries, both on September 11th, the most recent one, September 11th, 01, obvious and seared in our memory. That date, however, is the anniversary of a more forgotten and somewhat more positive anecdote. September 11th, 1964. Ring a bell with either of you guys? You're both old enough to remember this. Okay. The Beatles are scheduled to have a concert in Jacksonville, Florida. And they find out that that then being very much part of the Deep South, it was supposed to have been racially segregated.
Oh, gee.
They held up the – and at this time, the context, the Beatles were big, but they weren't wealthy. Because they're basically, you know, playing, you know, song residuals, you get nothing. John Lennon said, quote, "We never played a segregated audience and we aren't going to start now. I'd sooner lose our appearance money," unquote.
Impressive.
And the promoters backed down and they held an integrated concert. September 11th, 1964.
It's amazing how actions seemingly unrelated to the politics of the world make a difference.
Well, and sometimes you take a stand and it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And this is context, 1964. I mean, this is before Bloody Sunday. This is before the Voting Rights Act. This is of another era.
And yet today we have Laura Ingraham telling LeBron James, quit talking about politics.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane. Yeah, go dribble the basketball, please.
Yeah, the world has been changed by people who did not stay in their lane.
That's right.
Okay. More locally, the biggest news in the city of Phoenix has been Propositions 105, 106, both going down in flames. Rick, what were those about?
Well, they were about a variety of things. Mainly, they were about external control over what the city of Phoenix actually wants and trying to control them in being able to make decisions for the future.
That's conceptual. Let's make sure the audience understand exactly what they were.
Well, there was a vote for or against light rail. It wasn't just about the light rail extension into South Phoenix. It was about cutting out all light rail future expenditures and all expansion of light rail. This goes back to the 1950s when the rubber companies came out and made unfair and absolutely wrong studies that proved to cities that getting rid of trolleys was smart and putting in buses. It wasn't until 1980 that they paid hundreds of millions of dollars back to those cities. But by that time, all the light rail was gone.
They had trolley lines all around Los Angeles that they tore up.
They had trolley lines in Phoenix.
They had trolley lines in Bisbee.
Yes, they did.
Wow.
Think about that. Wow. But here's what it was. The Koch brothers came in and funded big time the yes vote, which means kill light rail. Also, there was
they're in the oil business and you sell more oil if everybody drives their own car.
Yeah. And then the other proposition 106 was about gutting pension systems for our first responders.
The mechanism said until you've fully funded these systems, you can't spend money on anything else. And
correct.
The funding is a long-term problem that you don't solve overnight. In effect, it ended up being a cap on spending for everything except police and fire.
Exactly.
In spite of all the money that was spent on the yes vote, meaning to kill these things, the people came out and voted no. They understood the value of light rail, and they understood the value of making sure pensions are fair and appropriate for our first responders in the city of Phoenix. The big loser in all this, I think, is probably Sal DiCicco,
who was out front on both.
Oh, he was. And probably the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Glenn Hammer, although he claims he really wasn't behind it. There's plenty of fingerprints to show that he was. But it was an impressive turnout for a special election. This wasn't our normal primary or general election. So
24%. I think it was in recent memory for a non-electoral contest. I think that's about as high as we've ever gotten.
And it lost 2-1. But there's another important part to this, and this is for the rest of the United States, because the Koch brothers are pushing this all over the United States in an attempt to stop light rail from expanding. The fact of the matter is that other cities paid attention when Phoenix was able to defeat this well-funded outside group because they were afraid of elections. Maybe they'll rethink it. Maybe they will do what's best for the city instead of what's best for the Koch brothers.
It's interesting that these ideas do percolate in that. I mean, our own Red for Ed movement, I think, was inspired by what was going on in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Our movement, in turn, inspired similar movements around the country. People do take notice of what's happening elsewhere.
The Red for Ed movement here in Arizona not only was just about education and getting appropriate funding for education, but it has now spurned a number of candidates for state legislature and other offices. And I think that's a direct outshoot of the effort that was put into the Red for Ed movement.
And I believe that also occurred across the United States. There are numerous congresspeople, mostly congresswomen, who are there because of the Red for Ed movement and its offspring.
I predicted that there will be a secondary impact of that. The number of those teachers who sat in the balcony at the end of the session where all the shenanigans go on.
Oh, they felt disrespected.
I can never see civics in high school being taught the same in this state for the next generation. All this textbook stuff about how a bill becomes a law that omits lobbyists and strike all provisions and all the other gamesmanship that goes on.
I remember as a young lawyer in Chandler, there was a court reporter who was big time in Republican politics. And she was amazing because she got all her fellow ladies out with clipboards for petition signatures to get candidates for office. When John McCain first ran for Congress in our congressional district, one of the first people he wanted to meet was Marcella Peters, our court reporter, because he knew she would do the grassroots work to get out there and get him on the ballot. Same thing with this Red for Ed. You make people feel disrespected, they're going to come back at you. And it's not just Red for Ed too. You look at the misogyny coming out of the Trump administration, right, and the Trump candidacy. There's a lot to inspire women now to run for office, and I see it as a good thing.
Before we leave the issue of the pensions, I want to ask both of you guys a kind of a hard question in that area, and it's based on observation I've long made. You know, there's a constraint on public spending by public officials because if you're going to spend money, you have to raise taxes in order to do it. And so there's some accountability there. In the case of pensions, we have the phenomena that an elected official can be extremely generous to public employees, giving them pensions, knowing that they will never have to pay for that. That'll be paid over the next 20 or 30 years by somebody else. What is the constraint on that that's similar to direct today spending?
Well, first of all, it's no different than Social Security. Social Security is not paid by me. Mm-hmm. I've been retired 3 years. I got every penny I put into Social Security in the first 2 years, as does everybody else. Social Security is paid for by other people in the future. Pensions are paid for by other people in the future. And generosity with pensions, the average Phoenix employee retires with a $29,000 a year pension. $29,000 a year.
You question the calculation of the shortfall. Is that what you're saying?
No. The shortfall should be figured over a 50-year period.
Yes.
The financial people say you got to look at least at 20 years. 25 is preferable, and 50 is probably appropriate. And so when you're looking at it just today, what the snapshot is today, you've got a totally wrong view of that pension so-called debt. Mm-hmm. It isn't debt. It is future income. I mean, that's really what how pensions are set up, and that's how they should be set up. And quite honestly, the firefighters and the police who get the best pensions deserve the best pensions because they're not paid the highest wages. And the average worker in the city of Phoenix who is non-fire, non-police, gets $29,000 a year on average.
What's the average for police and fire?
Well, it depends, honestly.
I mean, there's an average.
The average is somewhere around $42,000. Mm-hmm. But still, you're not talking about the pensions that legislators get. Legislators only have to serve for a couple of years.
They padded themselves.
And then you've got the congressional pensions, mm-hmm. which are unbelievable. You get paid your congressional salary forever.
No question there. But my question is, Are you questioning the arithmetic that says there is future indebtedness that has not yet been funded? Or are you saying that's a wrong calculation?
No, it's not a wrong calculation. It's wrong to look at it today and say
we shouldn't have to have money in the bank to pay for that in the future. That's being paid for by future revenue.
Exactly. Okay. Correct.
All right. We'll be back with Rick and Tom and all things Politico in just a minute in the think tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Rick DeGraw, Tom Ryan talking Arizona politics. Martha McSally, it looked like she has a well-funded primary opponent who is attacking her from the right. My question to you, and I'll start with you, Tom, this time. Do you think that McSally having a challenger from the right, there's two interpretations. One you could say is this makes her go further right, and that hurts her in the quest for the center. On the other hand, does it make her look a little more moderate, and therefore does that help her with the center?
Well, she already has a problem with the base in the Republican Party. If you go to the blog site Seeing Red Arizona, you can see that they're not a big fan of hers. She is late to the Trump party.
And hasn't she been a reliable vote down the line?
Yes. She
is not good enough.
Not good enough. No, that's the problem. You know, the Republican landscape over the last 10 years is littered with multimillionaires who come in who are really neophytes to the political process, who think they can take on either the establishment candidate or, they're going to buy their way out of it. Will Cardin comes to mind, for example. There was somebody I can't.
That sounds like Doug Ducey.
Yeah. Well, Doug didn't have a primary candidate like Dan McCarthy. Doug was him.
He also ran for treasurer first.
Yes, he had. Doug had some. He had some prior political experience running for the state treasurer's office, and he was blessed with two candidates who were good policy wonks, but not great retail campaigners. And so he's been able to stay in office. But getting back to Dan McCarthy and Daniel McCarthy and Senator McSally will end up winning that primary, is my opinion.
I'm just wondering whether it helps or not. Yeah.
All she needs to do is hug Trump, and that'll satisfy the Republican base. McCarthy is trying to go as hard right of her as he can. You know, he just dissed Governor Ducey and said, "I'm not appearing for my meeting. I think your call for red flag laws is an outrage and a violation of Second Amendment." So he canceled a meeting with Doug Ducey.
Okay, Rick, if McSally hugs Trump in the primary, does that make it more difficult for her in the general?
First of all, a Republican has to do more than hug Trump.
We would like them to, yes.
I'm not allowed to use the terminology of what you have to do, but I don't believe it helps her in the primary because with Citizens United, there's no end to the amount of money that she will have to be able to win, to try to win a seat. I believe Tom is correct in that the base is not solid McSally. While she has voted with Trump, 97% of the time, I believe.
She's been reliable.
She has not been a sycophant in the very beginning. She is now, but she's not in the very beginning.
There were a couple of comments in the beginning.
You're right.
That probably made her, not one of us kind of
But I have a separate thought. I believe every Republican candidate in Arizona should be required to answer the question, do you support Joe Arpaio for sheriff of Maricopa County? Because I believe that will be a helpful determinant for the far right.
Yes.
On whether or not they're actually really with them.
So if you're really part of the far right, you endorse Joe.
Absolutely.
I agree with that. I think that's actually a very good thing. A good thought, rather. That's not a good thing. It's a good thought.
My guess is the answer, that's a county election, and the county should decide on its own.
Right. And
which, of course, would be a non-endorsement.
And the response to that is, it's a county that you're supposed to be representing as the largest county. Now, what do you think?
You're still not going to get in.
Well, of course you're not. But if they refuse to endorse him, I believe that her opponent will endorse him.
Okay, for sure.
Absolutely.
That's how you get the right.
Right.
Real quick, we've got like 30 seconds on the way out. You think Joe has a shot?
No, I don't think Joe has a shot. I think Joe will actually get a 22-23% of the vote in a primary election.
Okay.
Yes.
Take him seriously. Always take him seriously. That's the idea.
Okay. We'll be back discussing other issues in the think tank when we return in just a moment.
The New Jerusalem. Sirens call them on with a song.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Mike O'Neill here with Rick DeGraw and Tom Ryan discussing Arizona politics. I want to move slightly to a broader topic, which is what is going on with the Arizona Republic. Clearly, newspapers are changing, but Tom, wonder if you want to walk us through the sort of the recent history with buyouts and attempted buyouts and things of that sort.
Absolutely. Well, the Arizona Republic is experiencing something of a longer trend here, as we've seen consolidation in the newspaper industry.
We were independent, and that got bought out by Gannett.
Right. First, it was Pulliam, then it got bought out by Gannett. Now it's been bought out by another media company, a large media company. The problem is, whenever you have a merger or an acquisition like this, they always talk about, you know, synergy. And what synergy simply means is somebody's going to lose a job because they want to cut costs.
You can fire a bunch of reporters and throw in some syndicated stuff.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, at the Arizona Republic, they've gotten rid of some of their greatest reporters, the Pulitzer Prize winning political cartoonist and Steve Benson.
Benson was the kind of probably the most recognizable product of the Arizona Republic to the rest of the world.
Anyway. Oh, yeah. He was phenomenal. The Mike Kiefer, who I consider one of the finest reporters in the court system, took a buyout. So what's happening is, when you see this kind of consolidation going on, it puts a lot of pressure on the people remaining behind in the newsroom.
And numbers, by the way, I recently heard they had something over 400 reporters down to 130 now.
Oh, it's been brutal. It's been a bit of a slash and burn down there. And so the pressure is on the newsroom then to do something. And right now the thought is unionization. And there's a big pressure within the Gannett system nationwide now to unionize the newsrooms. It's a bit
not by Gannett, rather probably opposed by Gannett.
Well, it's opposed by it was opposed by the CEO of Gannett, but the people on the news floor, it's the one doing the actual hard work every day, are very worried about losing their jobs, and they're losing their job in two ways. One is, you're being pressured out. Here's a buyout, or we no longer need three city reporters. We're going to one. And the other form of pressure is coming from, hey, we're gonna make up with
interns from your local journalism school. So our local newspaper newsroom is getting pressured on both sides, and that's really the impetus for the unionization move right now. And even within the newspaper room, it's controversial. Not everybody agrees with unionization on the news floor.
Yeah, I have no idea what the numbers are, but I've certainly heard scuttlebutt on both sides of this. There was a tweet by Yvonne Sanchez retweeted by Craig Harris that she had met with some of the folks on the newsroom floor who were in favor of it. She said she expressed some misgivings, and she thinks that she has been electronically stalked ever since. Rick, what's your take on what's going on there?
Well, first of all, I support the unionization of the newsrooms. I think protection of their jobs and their rights and everything else is very important. However, when an industry is dying, unionization is not always the answer because the industry is dying. Print has gone away all over the place.
And unionization does nothing to stem that tide.
No, unionization doesn't stem that tide. Unionization protects the workers and addresses conditions. But the tide is one that you can see happen other places where companies don't want to do something, so they just go bankrupt. They walk away. Everybody walks away with money except the workers. And they go out of business. And the advertisers go someplace else to the electronic world.
And that's some of what's behind this. We used to have big, fat, classified things in the paper. They're virtually non-existent now.
Right. That's the problem is the newspaper industry, that as we know it, they weren't really living off of subscriptions. What they were living off of was the advertising revenue.
Always.
And now the advertising revenue has found cheaper alternatives, things like Craigslist, the Auto Trader, eBay.
Yeah, if you were going to buy almost any kind of like small – buy anything from a private party, you're not going to look in the newspaper.
Well, you're not going to look at one of those. You're not going to look in the newspaper for a new car. You're not going to look in the newspaper to find a job. You're only going to look in the newspaper to find out who died. I mean, that's probably the most read part right now of the obituaries.
Auto advertisers are still there, but not in classifieds. The dealers are still there.
Right.
You know, there's a great book out there by a professor back at NYU. His name is Timothy Wu, W-U, and he wrote a great book called The Attention Merchant. And it's a book worthy of reading. But when newspapers first got started in the United States, the model really was like our Phoenix New Times, which is the newspaper is given away for free. Sensational reporting, basically, you know, People Magazine or Page Six out of London. But they made their money off of advertising. Phoenix New Times has survived because it is not dependent upon advertising in the same way the Gannett system is.
It does seem, if I think back to, say, 20 or 30 years, it seems a lot thinner. I'm guessing they're losing advertising
New Times?
The New Times. I mean, just it's physically not the size that it once
was. Every newspaper is doing that, and they have to figure out how to move to a digital platform. Otherwise, they're going to be going the way of the buggy whip.
Well, I've been told that even here at this radio station, that the website is a huge part of the business model right now.
Oh, I believe
it has to be. But, I mean, you look at other things. Even the price of paper has vastly changed in the last 20 years. So all the paper that newspapers use, it has grown up in price faster than the price of steel. So all of those things are coming together at one point to drive print papers out of business.
May not be the worst thing in the world in terms of the environment.
Well, here's what I think the new model is going to be. And it comes with certain risks and certain benefits. If you look now, we have Jim Small and Jeremy Duda and a number of other reporters creating the Arizona Mirror, which has been doing some excellent investigative reporting. They were able to recruit Steve Benson, a Pulitzer Prize winning political cartoonist, to their side. They've got some marvelous journalism going on there.
But we're talking there about essentially a nonprofit, right, that runs off largely off donations.
Well, it's kind of like KJZZ and NPR and PBS.
Yeah. Which is a little more than donations. But, a lot of sponsorship and donations.
And on a more national level, we see ProPublica, which is doing the same kind of work, but on a national level. And I see, they don't put out papers. They don't, they don't depend on advertising. They depend on people donating. That is a benefit. The risk is it becomes unmoored. So you could have somebody create an alternate site that starts doing, dishonest reporting or.
The thing about web-based stuff is some guy with a modicum of computer literacy can start up an entity and attempt to attract eyeballs.
We as a society are going to have to learn how to navigate between what is truth and what is not truth, what is real journalism and what is just journalism.
See some of these things that come on sites. They set up physical newsrooms that look like television stations.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have all the demeanor of a normal newsroom, except they're complete propaganda.
Yes.
25 years ago, I set up an international conference with Paul Elsner of the community colleges on the merger of entertainment, digital media, and news, and where that was going. And we concluded that it was all going to entertainment. And that's almost all what news is, whether you're looking at television, it's all entertainment of one sort or another. Which is why the fire is on the front page, and not what is happening in Yemen. That's why
especially in this country. In this country, we notoriously have no interest in any other country where we don't have troops.
Right. We know more about Kim Kardashian in her metallic suit in the Bahamas because of People magazine,
and even places where we have an interest because we have the troops. The day the troops leave, poof, it's off the page.
We don't care, right?
Yeah, no. It's
but let's get back to the union issue.
Yeah,
I mean, Arizona doesn't like unions. Now, my great grandfather used to get 2 days off a year, Christmas and Easter, and the only time he got another day off from the mines in Pennsylvania was when they closed the mines so everybody could go down to Reading and watch them hang the six Molly Maguires who had been found guilty. And unions changed that. The fact of the matter is unions have been great for American workers. Not good.
Five-day work week, vacations, sick pay.
Eight-hour day.
Weekends, lunch breaks. Water on the job, safety.
No child labor.
Well, at least supposedly.
Yeah. We've outsourced that to Vietnam now.
Right.
Yes.
But the fact of the matter is
here's the thing. We take all that stuff for granted now.
That's exactly correct. And it's been 30 years of attacking labor unions. And yes, there's been corruption in labor unions, but there's been corruption in every part of our government. And today we have the most corrupt administration we've ever seen.
We have corruption in corporate America.
Yes.
Look at the opioid crisis. And what are we doing with the Sackler family? Yeah, you got to keep all the millions and billions you made. You're just going to have to give up Purdue Pharma. Wait a minute.
Right.
There's the idea that only unions are corrupt or corruption only exists in unions is a flawed thought process.
But isn't that kind of a little bit of whataboutism? The issue of corruptions in union is a fair point. All that other stuff being fair, too, but that doesn't excuse it.
There are ways to deal with it other than to just trash the unions.
I've paid attention to history for a long time. Anytime a large amount of money is put in one place, there will be corruption.
Fair point. With that point, we will return for final segment with Tom Ryan and Rick DeGraw in the Think Tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Tom Ryan and Rick DeGraw. Question for you, Rick. This goes to one of those things that most people don't understand the significance of. It's part of the kind of electoral rules of the game, which often determine outcomes.
There has been a change legislation that changed the rules as far as making it more difficult to pass initiatives. Want to tell us, first of all, tell us what that is. And Katie Hobbs came out in support of that, and tell us about that as well.
Well, it's a strange situation in my mind. First of all, the legislature has been trying to slow down, limit, and many corporations slow down and limit the public's ability to get stuff on the ballot.
They hate it.
They hate it. That's correct. And so one of the things that they did was pass a law that said that if a petition signature gatherer was from out of state and they were subpoenaed to show up in a courtroom after the petitions were filed and they did not show up, that all the signatures they gathered, whether those signatures were valid or not, can be thrown out. Now, what that basically means is that if you are a professional signature gatherer, and there are many of both parties.
You've run petition campaigns,
absolutely,
haven't you? So tell us a little bit about that. And where do you find these people who pass the petitions?
Well, you can do two things. You can hire anybody at all and just pay them a minimum wage, or you used to be able to pay them by signature, but you can't do that anymore.
You got to pay them a lot more than minimum wage now.
You do now. But you can hire people off the street. That's a bad way to do it because they don't really understand what they're trying to gather. They don't understand the rules around the signatures, et cetera. So there are professional signature gatherers. They go all over the United States to do this, and they'll come in for a period of time, gather signatures, and go back home.
And get paid a pretty good premium now.
They get paid a pretty good premium now.
Because when the crunch comes and you got a lot of money in the bank and you're 100,000 signatures short, this is where you go.
Exactly correct. And that's both sides. Doesn't matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats. They all do the same thing. Well, it used to be that the court had to rule on the signatures themselves. If the signature gatherer was found to be corrupt, then you could throw out the signatures. But in this instance, all it is that the signature gatherer doesn't have the money to fly from Los Angeles to Phoenix or to take off from their job to come for a couple of days and
you subpoenaed. Running the campaign has spent your last nickel getting the signatures passed, and you probably can't afford to fly them in either.
That's correct. Then all their signatures, no matter whether the signatures are valid or not, get thrown out. I believe that goes against our Constitution. I believe that is just another way to stop the public from being involved in making laws in their own state. And Katie Hobbs, for whatever reason,
Democratic Secretary of State.
Yes. For whatever reason, came out and said that she supported that without saying so in so many words, and that it was constitutional. And that there was no guarantee that if you signed your signature to a petition, it would be counted. It was stupid. I believe it was a bad political decision for her. And I have no idea in the world why she did it.
I want to ask this specifically of you because you've been involved in passing petitions. And this is my proposal in the area. And it stems from basic democratic norms. I think we have this ability because it's in the Constitution, and the Arizona Constitution basically says the people are supreme. It says that the will of the people supersedes the legislature or anything else, and therefore we have certain rights, initiative being one, recall of judges, other kinds of provisions of the reform era in the early 1900s when we became a state. I find this whole business of paying people to pass petitions inherently to be noxious, because what that ultimately says is you can get anything on the ballot if you've got enough money in your pocket. My proposal would be the following. You may not pay anybody anything other than their legitimate expenses to pass petitions. This is the first part of the proposal. The second part of the proposal is to take down the number of signatures required substantially. In other words, I would like a system where a genuine citizen effort that has a lot of public support
has a shot to get on the ballot, but nobody has the right to buy their way on the ballot.
But there are several parts to that. One is reducing the number of signatures.
Absolutely.
We've been increasing the number of signatures
required. Because not only the increase in the number, but we've been imposing these rules that say—
More difficult.
That makes it much easier to throw stuff out.
Right.
And if you're going to throw, you can tighten the rules and throw out half the signatures instead of a quarter. De facto, what you have done has been to increase the number of signatures required. A couple of seconds, Red for Red did it, and they were projecting that they'd throw out 25% of the signatures because that's what you always get.
Right.
Well, these things were passed by teachers, and they followed the rules, and basically they were all clean.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. You're absolutely right. The Arizona Constitution says any power not given specifically to the state legislature is reserved in the people.
Which is unlike the U.S. Constitution. I mean, broader, more liberal than the U.S. Constitution.
The Constitution for Arizona was passed in 1910 during the Progressive Era. President Taft actually rejected
it. That's correct.
Because it was too Democratic.
And specifically because we allowed for the recall of elected judges. Uh-huh. So Arizona very cleverly said, all right, President Taft, recall is out. We then got our statehood, and the very first thing we did was we put recall of judges back in. But here's the issue. Initiative, referendum, and recall have traditionally been looked at with the concept of what is known as substantial compliance. In other words, if you have substantially complied with the law, we're going to let it move forward.
Is that signature real? Was it intended? Uh-huh. We're not worrying about the margins on the paper.
Correct.
As long as the intent is crystal clear.
The technical difficulties would be ignored. We wanted to know that you've substantially complied. That is now going the way of the loony bird, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And we're moving towards strict compliance.
Which means the right to throw out more and more signatures of people who legitimately intended to sign the paper.
Absolutely.
You're just enfranchising the people, not the petition passes.
Yes, this is not a good move.
Okay, we ran out of time. Always do. I'd like to have you guys back. Rick DeGraw, thank you very much. Tom Ryan,
thank you, as always,
in the think tank. By the way, you can find the old shows we had are all at ktar.com. The more recent ones, the things that are out a ways, are at mikeoneal.org. See you next week in the think tank.
Them, and sirens call them on.